Imagine stepping onto the floor of a massive brokerage firm.
Oh boy.
Yeah, but instead of this organized, heavily calibrated digital perfection, you walk into absolute unfiltered chaos.
Like a nightmare scenario.
Exactly. You've got rogue traders screaming across the room, phones melting down from unmonitored margin calls, people just casually trading on insider information next to the coffee machine.
Right.
And there's one guy in the corner trying to put out a literal trash can fire with a lukewarm cup of coffee.
It's a genuinely terrifying image. And honestly, it's a fairly accurate representation of what the financial markets would default to on a daily basis without the rigorous, albeit sometimes invisible, guardrails that we're unpacking today.
Yeah.
We love to think of high finance as this pristine algorithmic machine, but underneath the sharp suits and the fiber optic cables, I mean, it is just people.
Humans.
Right. And people make mistakes, they cut corners, they get greedy, and sometimes they accidentally start fires.
Which is exactly why we need a structure to contain that human element.
Yeah.
But before we dive into exactly how we build that structure, I just want to give a quick shout out.
Go for it.
So this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. If you are prepping for your exams, they have a full Series 99 course packed with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge for retention.
Yeah, it's designed to actually help you retain the information, not just stare at a textbook until your eyes cross. Check them out at certfuel.com.
Absolutely. So today's deep dive is incredibly specific and vital. We are pulling from a massive stack of sources today.
A lot of reading.
Yeah, FINRA Rule 3110 on supervision, SEC record-keeping mandates under Rules 17A3 and 17A4. We've got recent regulatory notices regarding business continuity and, of course, the official Series 99 exam guidelines. We are looking directly at Function 2 of the Series 99 exam, which is broker-dealer supervision and control.
And for whoever is listening to this right now, I am breaking the fourth wall for a second. Look at me. Do not let your eyes glaze over at the word compliance.
Yeah, don't do it.
This single unit is a whopping 30% of your entire exam.
30%.
That is 15 scored items. You cannot pass this test, you cannot get your license, and you just cannot get to the fun part of your career if you do not master the mechanics of this section.
And beyond just passing the exam, this material is the very foundation of how a broker-dealer survives reality.
Right.
Operations professionals, they live and breathe inside this control structure. It prevents catastrophic errors, it stops conflicts of interest, and it ensures the firm doesn't collapse when the power goes out. We aren't just memorizing rules today, we are looking at the architecture of survival in the financial industry.
I love that. Architecture survival. So, to help lock this architecture into our brains, we're going to use a little imagination today. Standard dry lectures are the enemy of retention, especially if you're like me and your attention span is, well, challenged. So I want to introduce you to the cast of characters for today's deep dive.
Let's hear it.
They run a fictitious, highly dysfunctional broker-dealer.
Nice.
First, we have Frank the founder. He is the CEO, he loves money, he hates rules, and he is constantly trying to cut corners to save a buck.
Basically, a compliance officer's worst nightmare, but a very real archetype in this industry. I've met a few Franks.
We all have.
Okay.
Next, we have Sally the supervisor. She is the overworked, incredibly rigorous registered principal.
Oh, poor Sally.
Yeah, she runs on stress and caffeine. Her entire existence is dedicated to desperately trying to keep the firm compliant so they don't all go to federal prison.
Doing the Lord's work.
And finally, we have Clueless Carl. He is a rookie associated person. He means well, he really does. But he accidentally breaks a federal rule almost every time he touches his keyboard.
What's fascinating about that, when you look at the regulatory history, is that almost every single rule we're going to cover today was written because a real-life Frank or a real-life Carl did something disastrous.
Right.
The regulations are literally written in the blood of failed firms. So today is all about the guardrails that Sally has to build to keep Frank from getting sued and Carl from blowing up the firm.
Let's start with the absolute foundation then, the blueprint versus the building. I'm going to pause for a second. Listeners, I have a direct question for you. Stop whatever you are doing and think about this.
Give it a second.
If FINRA RAW knocks on your door for an audit and asks to see your supervisory system, are they asking for a giant binder full of paper or are they asking for something else? Take a beat. What do you think?
They are definitely asking for something else. And this is one of the most crucial distinctions to make early on. Regulators love to test on this.
Yep.
The supervisory system is the actual living, breathing structure of the firm.
It's the reality.
Right. It is the people, the physical offices, the management hierarchy, the daily operations, and the workflows used to supervise the business. It is the machine itself.
So if the system is the actual machine, like the desks, the computers, the people checking the trades, what is the giant binder of paper?
The binder of paper is the WSPs, the written supervisory procedures. These are the documents that explain how the system is supposed to work.
Got it.
If the supervisory system is the physical building with its security guards, cameras, and locked doors, the WSPs are the architectural blueprints that show where the doors are, what the guards are supposed to do, and who is allowed inside.
Okay, here is where people completely misinterpret the rule, and exam writers love to punish them for it. The exam will try to trick you into thinking the WSPs and the supervisory system are the exact same thing.
They do it all the time.
They will use the terms interchangeably in a scenario question. Do not fall for it. The system is the operating structure, and the WSP is the manual describing the structure. You can have a beautiful manual, but if your actual system is garbage, you are failing compliance.
Exactly. Let's tie this back to our characters. Frank, the founder, he wants to wash his hands of all this compliance nonsense so he can just focus on making money.
Classic Frank.
So he formally assigns Sally, the supervisor, to handle all of it. He drafts a memo, puts her in charge of the supervisory system, and thinks, great, I delegated it. If clueless Carl messes up and steals the client's money, Sally takes the fall, not the firm.
I'm going to push back on Fenerai's logic here for a second, because I actually sympathize with Frank in this specific instance.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, in almost any other corporate environment, if a CEO delegates a task to a vice president and the VP completely bungles it, the VP is the one who gets fired or takes the hit. Why is the financial industry playing by entirely different rules? Why can't Frank just outsource his liability?
Well, it really comes down to the concept of systemic risk and ultimate investor protection. Broker-dealers are trusted with the public's life savings and the stability of the capital markets as a whole.
Yeah, fair.
Fenner's stance is that a firm cannot just point the finger at a middle manager when things go wrong to shield the enterprise. Assigning a registered principal like Sally does not transfer final responsibility.
Not at all.
Nope. The rule is explicit. Final responsibility for proper supervision always remains with the firm. You can delegate the task, you can delegate the daily grind, but you cannot outsource the ultimate liability. If the firm is making the profits from the transactions, the firm holds the bag when the transactions violate the law.
That makes total sense when you frame it around who is collecting the revenue. The entity making the money carries the risk.
Right.
Now, let's talk about updating these WSPs, these blueprints. Because the financial world is not static. Rules change. New products like complex derivatives or crypto assets hit the market. When do the WSPs actually need to be updated?
They must be updated promptly when applicable securities laws or FINRA requirements change, or when the firm's own internal supervisory system changes.
Stop right there. Listeners, notice the word promptly. The exam is going to offer you a very tempting multiple choice option that says WSPs only need to be updated annually. Why does annually feel so right to people?
Because so many other compliance requirements in this industry are on an annual cycle. You have annual meetings, annual certifications, annual audits.
Right.
But think about the danger of waiting a year to update a rule. If FINRA bans a specific type of aggressive sales practice in February, and Frank's firm waits until their annual review in December to update their WSPs, well, Clueless Carl is going to spend 10 months illegally selling products to retirees.
Oh, man. 10 months of Carl just wreaking havoc.
Exactly. The trigger for the update is the change itself, and the timeline is promptly.
But let's look at the mechanics of promptly. Say Sally, the supervisor, reads a new FINRA notice on a Tuesday. She diligently types up an amendment, prints it out, and updates the master WSP binder sitting on her beautiful mahogany desk. Is she done? Has she met the requirement?
Absolutely not. Updating the central document without communicating that amendment to the relevant associated persons is effectively useless.
Right.
The firm has to tell the people whose activities make that role relevant. If the blueprint changes, you have to tell the construction workers. If Sally just leaves the binder on her desk, Clueless Carl is out there on the trading floor entirely unaware that the speed limit just changed. The firm must promptly communicate the update.
Which brings up the paper trail.
Mm-hmm.
Because FINRA doesn't just take your word for it. They love paperwork. And they love knowing exactly who was responsible for what and when they were responsible for
it. Oh, they live for paperwork. The regulatory framework is built on accountability. If there is a failure, investigators need to know exactly who was in the supervisory seat on the day the failure occurred.
Makes sense.
Therefore, the firm is required to preserve the records of its supervisory personnel. This means documenting who the designated supervisors were and the exact dates they held those titles. And there is a very specific bifurcated timeline for how long these records must be kept.
All right, listener, I want you to burn this phrasing into your brain right now. 3 years total, 2 years easy.
That's good.
I'm not going to make you chant it, but I want you to visualize it. 3 years total, 2 years easy. Break down the mechanics of what that actually means in the real world.
It means the firm must keep those supervisory personnel records for a total of 3 years. However, for the first 2 years of that three-year period, those records must be kept in an easily accessible location.
See, I have always found this rule slightly bizarre. Why the split? Why not just say keep it for 3 years and let the firm figure out where to put it? What is the practical difference between easily accessible and just kept?
To understand the split, you really have to picture what a surprise Finera or SEC audit looks like.
Okay.
Imagine a team of regulators walking into Frank's firm on a random Wednesday morning. They're doing a sweep on unauthorized trading, and they want to know exactly who was supposed to be supervising Clueless Carl last month.
Sweating already.
Yeah. They demand the supervisory logs. They do not want Frank to say, oh, sure, we have those. They are in a deep storage warehouse in New Jersey. Let me submit a request, and we will have the boxes delivered in about 2 weeks.
Because that gives Frank 2 weeks to potentially tamper with the records, or at the very least, it stalls the investigation.
Precisely the fear. The regulators need immediate visibility into the current and recent operations of the firm. Therefore, the most recent 2 years of history must be immediately easily accessible, which often means digitally available or sitting in a file cabinet right there on site. The regulators want to see it before they leave the building.
And the third year?
The third year, which is older and less likely to be the subject of a sudden acute investigation, well, that can be sent to that deep storage warehouse in New Jersey. But it still must be preserved to satisfy the three-year statute.
Okay, so 3 years total, 2 years easy. Now, transitioning a bit, if the WSPs are the rules and the supervisors are the ones enforcing them, how do we make sure the enforcers aren't cheating? Because Frank, the founder, is always looking for a loophole, right? If the blueprint is perfect, but the builder is allowed to inspect their own work, the building is still going to collapse.
This brings us to a fundamental, non-negotiable concept of operational control. Segregation of duties.
The big one.
Yep. The underlying philosophy here is that power corrupts, and concentrated power in a financial institution corrupts disastrously.
Yeah.
The purpose of segregation is to divide functions and supervision among different departments and individuals so that control responsibilities do not concentrate in one single person.
To put it bluntly, if one person holds all the keys to the vault, the ledger, and the auditing system, an error or like an intentional multi-million-dollar fraud can pass by completely unnoticed. We have to divide the power. So what are the golden rules of segregation?
The firm's procedures must strictly prohibit an associated person from three specific, highly conflicted scenarios. First, a person cannot supervise their own activities. Second, a person cannot report to someone they supervise. And third, a person cannot have their compensation or continued employment determined by a subordinate.
Let's play this out with our characters to really highlight the absurdity, because sometimes the rules sound dry until you put a face to them.
Go for it.
So Frank, the founder, decides he wants to execute a series of highly risky, totally unapproved offshore trades. But the system is locked. He needs a supervisor's digital signature to release the funds. So Frank walks over to Clueless Carl's desk. Carl technically works for Frank.
Right, he's a subordinate.
And Frank says, hey, Carl, I am officially making you my designated supervisor for the afternoon. If you approve these trades for me right now, I will let you decide how big my Christmas bonus is this year, and I guarantee your promotion.
Which is a compliance nightmare that touches on almost every violation possible.
It's legalized extortion. Or bribery, depending on who initiated it.
It is the exact definition of a compromised environment. I mean, think about the mechanics of human nature. If Carl determines Frank's pay, or if Frank determines Carl's continued employment, Carl is never, ever going to say no to Frank's risky trades. He is fundamentally compromised.
Right.
You cannot have subordinate control of pay. You cannot report to someone who reports to you. And you absolutely cannot self-supervise. If you look at historical market failures, like the collapse of Barings Bank in the 1990s.
Oh, that's a classic one.
Yeah, it happened because one trader, Nick Leeson, was in charge of both executing the trades on the floor and settling the trades in the back office. He supervised himself, and he hid over $1 billion in losses until it literally broke the bank.
Okay, hold that thought. Pattern interrupt. I am thinking about reality versus the textbook here. It is really easy to segregate duties when you have a massive Wall Street tower with 1,000 employees. But what if a broker-dealer is literally just two people working in a basement office in Idaho?
Yeah, the small firm problem.
You can't perfectly segregate duties if you only have two human bodies in the room. Does FINRA just shut them down for being too small?
This is a fantastic point, and it leads directly into a documented exception you need to recognize for the exam. Regulators are actually aware of reality. They understand that not every firm is Goldman Sachs.
Yeah.
When a firm's size or a supervisor's position makes the strict separation of duties impossible, like your two-person basement firm in Idaho, the firm doesn't just get a free pass to ignore the rule. They can't just throw their hands up and say, oh, well, too hard.
So what do they actually have to do?
They must heavily document why separation is impossible. They have to lay out the structural limitations of the firm. And more importantly, they must document how they're using an alternative arrangement that still achieves compliant supervision.
It's the ultimate show your work rule. You can't just claim an exemption. You have to prove how you are mitigating the risk anyway. So maybe they hire an outside third-party auditor to review the trades every week, or they set up automated systemic flags that alert FINRA directly if certain thresholds are met.
You substitute physical segregation with enhanced procedural controls.
Now, while we are on the topic of controlling who does what and who has access to what, we need to do a side-by-side comparison of two concepts that candidates mix up all the time.
Oh, this is a big one.
Yeah, so if you are half listening right now, tune back in. Information barriers versus entitlement policies.
These two concepts are easily confused because they both deal with restricting access to information. But they do it at completely different levels of the organization, and they serve different regulatory purposes.
I see people get trapped by this constantly. Let's start with an information barrier. What is it, and how does it work in practice?
The core question an information barrier answers is, may information flow between departments? This is a macro level control. Historically, you might hear this referred to in old finance jargon as a Chinese wall. Its purpose is to stop systemic, massive conflicts of interest from occurring within a multi-service firm.
Give me a real world scenario. Let's use our characters.
Sure. Let's say Frank's firm has grown. On the 40th floor, they have an investment banking team. This team is currently working late into the night, secretly setting up a massive corporate merger where company A is going to buy company B.
Okay, big money.
On the 39th floor, the firm has a proprietary trading desk where traders are buying and selling stocks for the firm's own profit.
Oh, I see where this is going. If the traders on the 39th floor find out about the secret merger, they're going to buy a million shares of Company B before the news hits the public.
Which is textbook insider trading.
Yep.
The information barrier is the figurative and sometimes literal wall that stops the bankers from whispering secret merger news to the traders. It dictates that departments with material, non-public information cannot interact with, share servers with, or even sometimes use the same elevators as the trading departments. It controls the flow of information across massive groups.
Okay, so an information barrier is department-wide. It stops systemic flow. Now, contrast that with an entitlement policy.
If an information barrier is a wall between departments, an entitlement policy is a much more granular, microscopic control. It answers the question, which specific files, folders, and systems is an individual person authorized to use?
Ah, so this is individual. This is Clueless Carl's login credential.
Yes. When Carl logs into the firm's customer relationship management software, his entitlement policy dictates that his password only unlocks the accounts of his own specific clients.
He can't just browse around.
No, he cannot search the database and open up Frank's ultra high net worth client list. He cannot access the firm's master accounting software. He cannot view the HR payroll files.
Let's cement this comparison. Listeners, think of it this way. Information barriers block department-wide flow to prevent insider trading and systemic conflicts. Entitlement policies block individual access via passwords and keycards to prevent unauthorized snooping or individual data breaches. Wall between departments versus a keycard for a single person. Keep those distinct in your mind.
That is the perfect way to delineate them.
So let's take a breath and look at what we've built.
It's a lot.
It is. We have the blueprints, our WSPs. We've segregated the duties so the builders can't inspect their own work. We've locked down the passwords with entitlement policies and built information barriers between conflicted departments. We have effectively controlled the people.
We have.
But what happens when the chaos isn't caused by a person? What happens when the building literally catches fire?
This is where we transition from everyday operational supervision to crisis management. We are talking about the Business Continuity Plan, universally known as the BCP.
Let's set the scene with a ridiculous, but honestly entirely possible scenario. It's a Tuesday afternoon. A highly aggressive raccoon gets into the basement of Frank's firm and chews completely through the main server cables.
Sounds plausible.
The screens go black. The phones are dead. The Wi-Fi is gone. Clueless Carl is panicking because he was in the middle of executing a trade. What is the BCP actually supposed to do in this moment?
The BCP must be a written document, reasonably designed to let the firm meet its existing obligations to customers, and crucially, address its existing relationships with other broker-dealers and counterparties.
I want to highlight that second part, because people always focus on the retail customer.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you have to help grandma get her money out if she needs it. But the counterparty aspect is massive.
Right.
Why is Fenara so concerned about how Frank's firm interacts with other banks during a crisis?
Because the financial system is a deeply interconnected web.
Right.
If Frank's firm suddenly goes dark because of a raccoon or a flood or a cyber attack, they might owe $50 million in trades that were supposed to settle that afternoon with another major bank. If Frank's firm defaults on that settlement, the other bank doesn't get their money, which means they might default on a payment to a third bank.
It causes a rapid domino effect.
Exactly. This is systemic risk. The BCP is designed to stop the dominoes from falling.
And this isn't just theory. We saw this in 2012 when Hurricane Sandy flooded Lower Manhattan. Entire server farms in basements were literally underwater.
Mm.
Or even more recently with global IT outages, like the CrowdStrike incident where millions of screens just went blue. A BCP is not a hypothetical wish list.
No, it cannot be a document that someone wrote 5 years ago and stuffed in a drawer. The rule explicitly states it must identify procedures relating to an emergency or disruption so it stays a current working document. It dictates where the backup servers are, who holds the emergency cell phones, and how trades will be routed if the primary clearing firm is offline.
Okay, here is a massive trap that catches very smart people on the exam. Pay close attention. Who owns the BCP? Who actually approves it and reviews it? Because if you have ever worked in corporate America, your brain is going to scream that a document this important must be approved by, like, the Risk Management Committee or the Board of Directors.
And if you choose a committee on the exam, you will get the question wrong.
Right.
The rule is incredibly specific. It is exactly one person. The responsibility is placed entirely on a designated member of senior management who is also a registered principal.
I want to push back on that for a second because logically, a committee has more diverse expertise. You have IT experts, legal experts, trading experts. Why would FNR force one single person to bear the weight of approving the entire disaster plan?
Because a committee is a place where accountability goes to die.
Wow. Okay. Fair point.
When a crisis hits and the servers are underwater and millions of dollars are vaporizing by the minute, you cannot wait for a committee to convene and vote on a course of action. PNRA wants one clear leader. They want one throat to choke if the plan fails.
One throat to choke. That's visceral.
It's true, though. It is not enough to just be a manager, and it's not enough to just be a principal with a license. You have to be both. Sally, the supervisor, assuming she has a senior management title, fits the bill perfectly. She approves it initially, and she conducts the required annual review. Solo. No hiding behind a committee vote.
Accountability is key. Now, part of this plan requires the firm to report emergency contact information directly to FNRA. Because if the raccoon destroys the servers, FNRA is going to notice the firm fell off the grid, and they're going to call to figure out what is going on. Who do they call?
The firm has to provide FNRA with two designated associated persons as emergency contacts. Contact number one has to fit the exact same profile we just discussed. A member of senior management who is also a registered principal, that would be Sally.
So FNRA calls Sally first. She is the commanding officer. What about the second contact? Do they also have to be a registered principal?
No, the second contact does not necessarily have to be a registered principal. However, they must be a member of senior management who intimately knows the firm's operations.
Let's explain the logic there. If FNRA is calling in the middle of a systemic meltdown, they don't want to talk to an intern who just started on Tuesday.
Right.
But they also don't want to talk to Frank, the founder. if Frank is just a figurehead CEO who doesn't actually know how the clearing software connects to the depository trust. They need to talk to someone who understands the actual plumbing of the firm.
Exactly. Federon needs actionable information during a crisis, not a PR spin. Now, beyond Federon and the counterparties, we have to talk about the customers. Because if I'm a customer of Frank's firm and I try to log in to check my retirement account and the website is down and the phone lines give me a busy signal, I am going to panic.
Direct question to the listener right now. Stop driving, stop walking. Just focus on this scenario for a second.
Pay attention.
Frank, the founder, decides he wants to save some money on postage and printing costs. He takes the firm's brand new, beautifully updated business continuity plan, puts a sleekly formatted summary of it right on the homepage of the company website, and tells Sally, great, it is online for the whole world to see. We never have to physically mail this disclosure to anyone ever again. Is Frank right? Take a guess.
Frank is, in classic fashion, completely wrong. The rule is highly specific about how and when customers must be informed regarding the BCP. Posting it on a website does not replace the fundamental delivery requirements.
Regulators love to test this because technology has changed, but the core rule has not.
Customers must receive written disclosure of how the firm addresses business disruptions at account opening, period.
At account opening.
When they are signing the paperwork to open their account, that disclosure must be in the packet. Yes, if the firm has a website, they must post the summary there as well. But a digital posting does not eliminate the requirement to provide it in writing when the account is established.
And what if a customer who has been with the firm for 10 years calls in and says, hey, I saw a news report about cyber attacks. Can you send me your continuity plan?
If a customer requests a copy of the BCP disclosure by mail, the firm must mail it to them. You cannot just tell the customer, oh, go look at the website. You must fulfill the request via mail, written at account opening, posted on the website if you maintain one, and mailed upon request.
Okay, we are moving into our final major phase of the operational lifecycle. Checkups and certifications.
Almost there.
We have spent this entire time building. We have our WSPs. We have segregated our duties. Our passwords are secure via entitlements. And our raccoon-proof fire drill BCP is locked and loaded. How does Fianrod know we are actually maintaining all of this year after year? Do they just trust us?
The financial industry does not operate on trust. It operates on verification. And Fianrod verifies through mandatory annual requirements. The first of these is the annual compliance discussion.
What does that entail?
Every single registered representative and registered principal must attend a compliance meeting at least annually. Not every 2 years, not every quarter, annually. Persons designated by the firm conduct it. It can be an individual one-on-one interview, or it can be a massive group meeting in a hotel ballroom.
But here is the critical word you need to listen for. The hinge on which this entire rule swings. Relevant.
Very important word.
The discussion must address compliance matters relevant to the participants' actual activities. Let's bring back Clueless Carl to illustrate why this matters.
Let's look at Carl's daily routine. Carl's entire job is selling basic, plain vanilla mutual funds to retail clients. That is all he is licensed and authorized to do. Frank, the founder, wanting to save time, decides to hold one giant 3-hour annual compliance meeting for the entire firm.
Classic Frank.
Frank spends the entire 3 hours talking about the new SEC regulations for high-frequency algorithmic options trading and the nuances of dark pool liquidity. Does this satisfy Clueless Carl's annual requirement?
Obviously not, but explain the psychology of why regulators care. I mean, why shouldn't Carl learn about dark pools?
Because it creates compliance fatigue. If you force an employee to sit through hours of training on rules they will never use, they tune out. And when they tune out, they miss the warnings about the rules they do use. The discussion wasn't relevant to Carl's activities. You cannot make him sit through options training if he only sells mutual funds. The firm must tailor the discussion so that it actually applies to the risks and routines of what the participant does on a daily basis. It forces the firm to actively analyze what their people are doing.
Which means poor Sally, the supervisor, probably has to design and run 5 different compliance meetings for 5 different departments just to make sure the content is relevant for everyone.
It is a demanding job, which is why compliance officers are often heavily caffeinated.
God bless Sally.
And speaking of demanding jobs, let's look at the absolute peak of the mountain when it comes to accountability. Frank, the founder's biggest annual responsibility, the CEO annual certification.
Every single year, the CEO, or an equivalent chief officer, has to sign a formal certification. And this is a massive area for confusion. What exactly is Frank signing his name to?
The exam will present a scenario trying to convince you that the CEO is certifying that the firm had perfect compliance. It will sound very official. It will suggest he is signing a document stating that no rules were broken, no one made a mistake, and the firm operates flawlessly.
Which, if you think about it for 3 seconds, is logically impossible.
Completely impossible.
If you have thousands of human beings working for you, someone, somewhere, is going to make an error, a typo, a missed deadline, a bad recommendation. So if Frank isn't certifying perfection, what is he putting his signature on?
He is certifying the process. In legal terms, he is stating that the firm has processes in place to establish, maintain, review, test, and modify their written compliance policies and WSPs. He is certifying that the system is reasonably designed to achieve compliance with applicable securities laws and FINRA rules.
Let's break down that phrase, reasonably designed. That gives the firm breathing room, right?
Exactly. It covers the process, not a guarantee of zero errors. When Frank signs that document, he is legally saying, I certify that Sally built the guardrails. I certify that we actively test the guardrails to see if they hold weight. And I certify that we have a mechanism to fix the guardrails when we realize they are broken.
Okay, so he's not certifying that clueless Carl didn't accidentally trip over a guardrail yesterday.
No. He is certifying that when Carl tripped, the firm had a system to catch him, report it, and train him not to do it again.
Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today, from the basement blueprints to the CEO's desk. We are going to shift gears into our rapid-fire exam recap. This is the final sprint. High energy. I am going to throw out the concept and you give us the distilled, testable takeaway. Listeners, test your attention. Try to answer the concept in your head before the answer is revealed. Ready?
Let's run it.
Number one, the supervisory system versus the WSP.
The system is the living operating machine of the firm. The WSP is the written architectural manual that describes it. They are not interchangeable. And remember, assigning a supervisor to a task does not transfer ultimate regulatory responsibility. That always, always stays with the firm.
Number two, the golden rules for segregation of duties.
You cannot self-supervise. You cannot report to someone you supervise, and a subordinate cannot determine your compensation. If your firm is genuinely too small to physically separate these duties, you must heavily document the exception and prove your alternative mitigating controls.
Number three, WSP record retention.
Think of the timeline. 3 years total, 2 years easily accessible. That split ensures regulators have immediate access to recent history during a surprise audit, while older records can be moved to deeper storage.
Number four, information barriers versus entitlement policies.
Barriers block department-wide flow, like stopping investment bankers from whispering secrets to proprietary traders. Entitlements block individual access, like controlling Carl's specific login permissions to ensure he only sees his own clients.
Number five, BCP ownership and approval.
The business continuity plan is approved and annually reviewed by exactly one designated person who is both senior management and a registered principal. It is not approved by a committee. One throat to choke.
Number six, BCP customer disclosure.
Putting the plan on your website does not replace the requirement to deliver a written disclosure to the customer at account opening, nor does it replace the requirement to mail it if the customer requests a physical copy.
Number seven, the CEO annual certification.
The CEO certifies that the firm has the processes in place to manage and test compliance. They are signing off on the system's design. They are not certifying perfect, error-free execution.
Boom, that is function two. You now have the mechanical understanding to navigate the WSPs, segregate the duties without causing a conflict of interest, and survive the BCP fire drills.
Before we sign off, I want to leave you with a real-world thought exercise to take with you today.
Let's hear it.
Think about the last time a major app on your phone or a massive global bank went down for a few hours. Millions of dollars were frozen in digital space, people couldn't buy groceries, and markets began to panic.
It's scary stuff.
It is. So the next time you see a headline about a massive server outage or a cyber attack, ask yourself, who was their Sally the supervisor? What did their business continuity plan actually say they were supposed to do when the alarm started ringing, and did they follow it?
Because somewhere in that burning building, there was a blueprint. You just have to hope they remembered to read it. Keep studying, trust the process, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.